Okay. Seems like every time I come here, I'm apologizing for my voice because each time it gets softer and softer. I got a call today from the speech therapy department at Harvard Vanguard saying, we have a time for you. So we'll see what comes of that. But if for some reason you shouldn't or should fade out, you're not hearing well in the back, let me know and I'll try and speak a little louder. Drives my family nuts. But. So, you know, every time I think about giving a Dharma talk, it's like looking in the mirror. It always brings me up against the sort of deepest things in myself and in all of us. And there's always a choice point. Do I go forward or do I sort of cover that over and go back? The older I've gotten, the less thrilled I am about giving Dharma talks, actually. I'm not sure exactly why, but I'd rather it be more of a conversation where we talk with each other and support each other and inspire each other, rather than me up here, anyone up here, sort of telling you the way reality is. That feels so bogus to me. So I don't want to do that tonight. I'll suggest a couple of things along the way that we could talk about, but also invite you to contribute whatever is on your mind. Sometimes in practice, you know, we get hung up over a particular thing or a particular idea or a particular sticking point. And we carry that around with us for a long time. I want to invite you to put it on the table tonight if there is something like that for you. We'll see what we can do to respond, to answer it. So, I was thinking how life is certainly our greatest teacher. And no matter how advanced we are in practice, life will occasionally throw us a curveball. Sometimes a little one, often a very big one. Usually when we're least prepared for it. Life is very humbling. Again, the older I get, the more humbling life gets, the more clear it is that it's certainly not under my control, not under anyone's control, but we maintain that illusion as though we had some kind of control. So it's humbling. 3 weeks ago, I think, I spent the whole day in the emergency room, one of our local hospitals, probably in as much pain as I've ever felt in my life. And no one seemed to be paying too much attention to it except me. Finally, after hours and hours on a gurney, I had opened the curtain so that at least people could see I was in there. And a nurse walked by and she stopped and did a double take and she said, are you all right? I said, well, as a matter of fact, no. She said, well, what are you waiting for? I told her. I told her, and she said, well, wait, I'll get something for you. So she came back with a pillow and a blanket. They were the two most precious gifts that she could have given me. This was after hours. And, well, just to provide some context, when I got out of the hospital, I went to see my acupuncturist and herbalist. And he said, well, you know, what do you expect? When they did the chemotherapy and the radiation and the Rituxan, they didn't think that, of course, it was going to kill everything in there, right? Those, I'm sure there are a bunch of you in the room who have had this experience. But chemo kills everything. It doesn't just kill the good guys, the bad guys, it kills the good guys. And so he had had me submit a sample for analysis. It came back, I've got lots of bad bacteria. I've got almost no good bacteria. He said, we've got to have a plan to, you know, first get rid of the bad bacteria and then build the gut back up again. And believe it or not, none of my regular medical team had suggested that. It seems so obvious in retrospect. So, in the middle of this struggle and feeling, you know how you feel in a situation like that. You feel a little embarrassed, a little ashamed of yourself for feeling so terrible and for crying over it. Certainly the person in the next cubicle is doing a much better job than I'm doing. And after 40-some years of meditation practice, shouldn't I be much more on top of this than I am? Shouldn't the practice be making more of a difference? Now, you know, we can think about what that means. But in those moments of crisis, everything kind of pulls down to the lowest common denominator. And somewhere in the middle of all of this, maybe a little bit closer toward the end, but before I'd gotten any relief, still in this terrible pain state, I remembered something my teacher had taught me years and years ago, way back in maybe 1976. This was Munindraji. Some of you may have met him when he came here. He's passed several years now. But he was the teacher I went to India to study with. Same teacher that Joseph studied with. And he was a very unconventional teacher. He taught in the old traditional style where teacher opens his door at sunrise and closes the door at sunset. In the meantime, anyone walks in and out any time of the day with any kind of a question. And if you don't have a question, he had a question for you. And I had also gone there to get material for my doctoral thesis, but that was the cover story. The real intent of in going there was, of course, to learn the practice and learn the Dharma, which he was only too happy to teach. He'd go up to his room after breakfast, maybe 8 o'clock in the morning, and ask him a question, Manindraji. What does it mean when the Abhidhamma talks about? And he would start talking. And at 12 noon, he'd still be talking. He would just go and go and go. And finally he said, Manindraji, it's noontime, it's lunchtime. We're all hungry, stop. We'll come back after lunch, we'll pick it up again. But he was so full of energy and so full of joy for the Dharma. That was the greatest teaching. Yes, he knew all of the scriptural texts. And yes, he'd gone to the stage and that stage of practice. But the great thing about him was his joy and how alive he was in the practice. So one day he had moved into the Chinese temple just outside town. And he said, let's go for a walk. Great. So we started walking down toward the Japanese temple. And I was, it's a little bit embarrassing now, I was so naive at the time. I didn't know what to ask him. I felt odd asking him anything. But I also had some of that same joy and that great curiosity. I wanted to know. So I asked him what I thought was a really profound question. I said, Manindraji, what is the Dharma? A simple question, what is the Dharma? And the thing that impressed me about his answer was not the words, but how he immediately replied. There was no hesitation between my asking the question and him responding to it. He was so deeply immersed. What is the Dharma? And his answer? He said, Dharma is living the life fully. Title of tonight's talk. Dharma is living the life fully. Now, at another time, I might have asked the Manindraji, what is the Dharma? He might have said something very different, another aspect. The Dharma is like a jewel with a lot of facets, and he happened to pick this particular facet on this particular day. But it's a very profound one. Dharma is living life fully. So it went in here, it kind of rattled around for a while. I said, and thought to myself, gee, that's profound. I've got to think about that when I go home. And it went out here. But something took, because it never left me. It's always been my koan of koans, living life fully. What does it mean to live life fully? Well, maybe I can give you a couple of examples. When I first got there, I think it was about 6:30 in the morning. It was cold, it was in January. The rickshaw wala had ripped me off for 50 rupees, which I didn't know any better. And Manindraji was still upstairs somewhere in the building, so I had to wait for him for a while. So he finally came downstairs. And before he was barely seated and we'd introduced ourselves, I said to him, Manindraji, I've come all this way, halfway around the world. I'm ready to start. What do I do? Tell me what to do. You know what he said to me? He said, how are your bowel movements? How are your bowel movements? Well, he had his eye on the ball, even if I didn't. because as a matter of fact, they weren't too good. So for the first 2 weeks, we just worked on my bowel movements. Now, his father had been an Ayurvedic physician, so he wasn't coming out of right field. He knew what he was doing, but he also knew how to prioritize. And at that moment, sitting, I came straight from a three-month course, been sitting 10, 12, 14 hours a day. To go back and try and do that again would have been nuts. Might have killed my taste for the practice. So he got my system regulated, and then we could start. Except that in all the time I spent with him, the several years I was there, he never once taught me meditation. Not once. And that's what I'd gone there, of course, to learn. That's what probably you would want if you went there. A great teacher. He's going to teach me the Dharma. And he never did. Didn't give me one bit of instruction in Vipassana. And it didn't matter to me in a way because I was so alive at that point. So much was happening. It was so wonderful. It didn't bother me. I didn't even think very much about it. I just was just doing the thing, next thing in front of me. But one day, about toward the end of the first year, we were walking back from the Japanese temple, and he looked at me and said, "You are still sitting, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, Manindraji, I'm still sitting." "Oh, good, good, keep sitting." That was it. 2 years, thousands of dollars later, and this is what I get. But he was right. It took me a long time to realize it. I don't think I realized it till I got back home. But the one thing I did not need was more instruction on how to sit. I'd just been doing that for months and months. And what I needed help with, what I need some instruction in, was how to live. Not how to sit, but how to live. That was his great teaching to me. So what does it mean, how to live fully on a gurney? Or in any of these crazy situations we find ourselves in? What does it mean, not just to live, but to live fully? I think the second day I was there, I had gone up to... At his suggestion, I'd gone up to meet with Shibu-san, who was the Zen teacher at the Japanese Zen temple there in Bodh Gaya. And he and his assistant were maybe in their 30s, 40s. He was an immaculate man, just an immaculate. You could cut your finger on the crease of his robe. Just exquisitely fine and very polite and very genteel. So Manindra said, "You go up and ask him for a room." There were no rooms in Bodh Gaya at that point. And what space was available was really, ugh. You wouldn't want to know about it. So Manindra said, "Go up, ask Shiba-san. He will give you a room." I went up and I asked Shiba-san about a room. No. So I went back to Manindraji and I said, "Manindraji," he said, "no." "No room." Manindraji said, "Oh, he can't do that." He said, "You have come here to study the Dharma. We must make it possible for you to study the Dharma." I will go up with you and talk to him. So we turn around and we trudge back up the rice paddy and we get to the Japanese temple. And Shiba-san and his assistant sit on one side of this low table and Munindraji sits on the other side and I'm kind of at the end of the table. And Munindraji started in, it was like an old union organizer. He just talked and he talked and he talked. And finally, at the end, Shiba-san held up his hand and said, "Wait." And there was this hurried conversation between Shiba-san and his assistant. And then he turned around, he looked at Munindraji and he said, "Okay." So Munindraji never said, "I told you so," but he was full of life. He wasn't afraid to try anything. He had this great curiosity and was a wonderful role model for me. That was the kind of teaching that I needed, not more sitting on the zafu. I did that again when I got home, but in my own time, but not on his time. One day he took me up to the roof of the Japanese temple, and it's hot, right? Summer's coming on, steaming hot. And he sweeps his hand across the horizon. He says, "Isn't this beautiful?" I look down, all I see are these shriveled up, vegetable plants in this baked like concrete dirt. But in his eyes, he saw the beauty in it. I couldn't see, at that point, I could not see the beauty in it. I just thought, "Oh my God, I just got here and this is the way it's going to be for 2 years." And then it could manifest in other ways too, which are a little bit more problematic. One day, Deepa Ma had a whole bunch of her students over to her room. Deepa Ma, some of you probably know, Nani Barua, an extraordinary woman, Bengali woman in Calcutta. I'll say more about her in a second. But she invited all of these female students over to hear Munindraji give a talk. And first of all, he was late. I kept telling him, "Munindraji, we gotta go. They're waiting for us. Yeah, okay. So we get there, and Ma was sick that day. She was running a fever, and her health was not good anyway, despite being this great yogi. And she was leaning on the charpoy up against the wall of her room. And it looked like she was out of it. She'd fallen asleep. Meanwhile, Munindraji's talking and talking to her students. And all of a sudden, let me use the English, this question came up in Munindraji's talk about what does it take to become a Buddha? What sort of credentials do you have to be a Buddha? It's great. These are the things they talk about. And he had inadvertently, I think, happened to mention that one of the requirements for being a Buddha was taking birth in a male body. Bad. Very bad. Even at that time in that culture, very bad. And as soon as he said that, Deepa Ma shot off the wall. And she said, "I can do anything a man can do." And the place broke up because they all knew it was true. So I thought this was very strange. So in taking Menindraji home afterward, I said, Menindraji, where did you get that? He said, oh, it's in the Atasalani, which is one of the classic commentaries in the Buddhist canon. And I just happened to have a copy of it. So guess what? I went home. I asked him for the reference. He gave me the reference. I thought, he really knows the canon. He gave me I looked up the reference. There was nothing there about it. So he wasn't a saint, but he was a wonderful teacher who inspired a lot of people and lived life fully. Living life fully meant, you know, not being a very stern, very stiff kind of monk. He had tried that for 1 year, gave it up. But it meant being full of life and full of interest and curiosity about the things that really mattered. So then to go back, by way of finishing this, go back to the hospital in the gurney. I asked myself on the gurney, now what does living life fully mean right at this moment? And I realized a couple of things. One of them was that living life fully isn't living up to a bar that you've set for yourself or other people have set for you. Maybe the fullest you can live in this moment is 5%. But if that's the fullest you can live, then that's what you should be living. Not trying to live above that. That's a problem in spiritual practice. We're always getting a little bit ahead of ourselves or wanting to be or hoping to be. And a lot of the joy goes out of the practice and the aliveness goes out of the practice when we do that. So it can be just a little, but if that little is all we've got, then let's give it all we've got. And if what we're capable of is 100%, that's usually harder for us, it's scarier. To live fully at 100%, but then that's what we should be aiming for. And letting it go at the same time. It may be what we should be aiming for, but we still may find we're not capable of it. That's got to be okay too, right? Yeah. I think I hadn't realized how much I missed him. Well, let's stop there. And let me open it up to all of you. Comments, questions.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.